Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And in the original land of self-made wealth, America, strike it rich, America, we consider the price of coasting. Do you have a price of coasting? What would it take to take the pressure off of you to make it feel all downhill? Back in the 1950s, there was a real easy answer to that.
My name is Michael Anthony, and for many years, I was executive secretary to John Beresford Tipton, the multi-billionaire, whose charity was as boundless as it was mysterious. For it was his hobby to give away, anonymously and tax-free, $1 million apiece to various people he never knew.
The millionaire TV show, every struggling play-by-the-rules American could relate to some guy in a suit coming to the door with a check for $1 million. And that still holds even for some people today.
My name is Don from Bedford, Texas, and the amount of money that would make me feel rich is $1 million.
$1 million!
An even number which says I'm a millionaire.
All right, Don. Still six zeros there for Don. In self-made wealth America, the prototypical millionaire for years was the frugal blue-collar type who squirreled it away quietly and slowly and ended up with a surprise few million in the bank, a house all paid off, whose only ostentatious mannerism was a very green lawn cared for on a shiny top-of-the-line riding lawnmower. I love that guy. I just wish he wouldn't work on Saturdays. You know him. But America has changed a lot. Personal income has stalled for a generation in the U.S. Playing by the rules is more often seen as a game for suckers. And the once orderly pass down of inheritance, even within the middle class, is mostly gone. The millionaires of America today are a hodgepodge of hard work, good fortune, and inspired entrepreneurial ideas. And there are apparently a lot of them. New figures from the market research group, the Spectrum Group, put the number of American households with a net worth of more than $1 million at 10 million. That's a new high. The other big change is that $1 million apparently doesn't feel like $1 million anymore. I'm joined by Ron Lieber. He's the Your Money columnist for our partner, The New York Times. He's the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, a book about teaching kids about money and values. Ron, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's nice to be back.
So let's talk about $1 million and how it doesn't really feel rich in the way that it did in the 1950s when they were handing out checks on the TV show.
Well, here's one way to think about it. If you're a retired person or approaching retirement, you got to think about what that's going to do for you over possibly 30 years that you may still be alive. You know, the standard financial planning practice suggests that you can yank maybe 4% of that each year. So you got $40,000 coming to you. You probably got to pay taxes on that, depending on what kind of retirement account it comes from. And then maybe you're getting some Social Security too. So depending on where you live, this might be enough for, you know, a decent retirement, but it's probably not enough to make you feel rich when you take it out each and every month.
And $1 million in Paris, France is a little different than $1 million in Paris, Texas. In this survey, who are the millionaires?
Well, here's something to think about when it comes to these millionaires and when it comes to thinking about surveys,
right?
So here, you know, we're talking about people who have self-reported their millionaire status. Many of them are trying to put a value on small businesses that they don't intend to sell.
So it's not in cash.
It's not in cash. It may well be the valuation of something that you own. For some of them, it may be cash, right? But you know, here's the thing about this. We always think about millionaires, people who have become millionaires, as people who have taken a lot of risk. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, one thing about these millionaires is that while they may say that they are interested in taking more risk in the future, they may not have taken all that much risk in the past. They may have been slow and steady savers over 20 or 30 or 40 years, gotten lucky in real estate, and they just slowly socked it away. They caught, you know, the market updraft the last 6 or 7 years, and all of a sudden they find themselves millionaires. And it wasn't because they took a big risk. It was because they got lucky to have saved at the right time, and they got lucky that they didn't have to break into that nest egg for some health disaster or a long-term period of unemployment.
Is the era of the millionaire next door, that book from the 90s, the author of whom just died, is that era over?
No, I don't believe it's over. Again, I think you need a lot of luck to be able to save consistently for 20 or 30 or 40 years and not have to bust into it for some healthcare calamity or a period of unemployment or an economic moment that wipes out your small business. But it is still the case that there are all sorts of ways in relatively unglamorous industries like the one that those two authors describe to become a millionaire by building a business and doing things that can't be stolen by an app or a website or can't be done by somebody in China. You can still have a plumbing business. You can have a plumbing supply business or from owning a couple body shops. I mean, these are all things that we still need and that cannot be outsourced.
And this survey suggests that even the well-off aren't terribly candid when it comes to telling their kids about how much money they have.
Only 40% of the people in this survey tell their kids their income. 62% eventually tell them the net worth, but that's often when they're adults. And when you ask them why, fully a third of them say that it's none of their business. This is a terrible thing to say. First of all, it's not true, right? If you're in the family, it's revenues and expenses are your business. They impact you, right? You can't tell kids that. But the other thing that makes it a problem is that if you say that to children, they will come to the conclusion that this matter of great import and mystery and power, money, is an off-limits subject, that they are not to come to you on that. And maybe they conclude that they're not to come to you about sex or drugs or mental health or other important things too. Do not say that to your children.
Do you have a number that would make you comfortable?
Is that today?
Today.
And comfortable to walk away from my job, which I don't think I would do because I like it too much?
Right.
I got to do that math in my head.
Actual math. I'm impressed.
I think my number is about $10
million. $10 million. My wife says $7 million.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about, all right, what would $10 million a year throw off in interest? And right now interest rates are pretty low. So you've got to think about dividends from stocks. And I'm thinking, okay, well, $10 million might throw off, $300,000-$400,000 a year if I'm lucky. I got to pay some taxes on that. I don't really want to bust into the principal if I'm going to need it for another 50 years because, I'm only in my 40s. So I think that's about it.
So what's your lottery number out there? Call us at 877-8-MINDTAKER. Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Rod Lever, author of The Opposite of Spoiled, a book about teaching kids about money and values. He's the Your Money columnist for The New York Times, our partner. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you.
Where's the money? Where's the money?
Money talks.
Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money.
Isn't this guy supposed to be a millionaire?
Just follow the money.
Yes, well, all of us little people dream about millions. In Washington, D.C., it's billions they transact in. And the big winner in the GOP budget unveiled yesterday is the Pentagon, while the big losers are food stamp recipients. How big of losers are those food stamp recipients? Well, Texas Representative Mike Conaway did not want to get specific.
I'm not answering your question. Okay. It's premature. I'm giving you the classic political nonsense. It's premature. I'm not going to give you a specific where I'm going to cut anything, where it's going to be proposed. I'm going to look at all of them and give you that kind of the 10,000-foot, nonsensical kind of thing that we're polished to do.
All right, Mike. All right. I'll stop asking. House Republicans want the new GOP-led Senate to pass a filibuster-proof bill and put it on the president's desk where the real horse trading on federal spending could then begin. Joining me now, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Hey there, Todd.
Hi, John.
So I'm looking at this budget. It seems like the old program of the Republicans, but with the new faces in the House and Senate, they've got the majorities, so they want to just try to get past what they could never get past in the past.
Very, very similar this year to the Ryan budget of years past, which was so politically consequential for so many Republicans in their elections. So this budget, courtesy of the new Senate budget chairman, Tom Price of Georgia, is very similar to the Ryan budget in its broad outlines. But defense is the huge difference. Why? Because of sequestration. You remember those automatic cuts. This goes back to all the budget fights and the fiscal cliffs from 2011 and 2012. Well, sequestration is in place. And this next year, John, sequestration says an automatic $54 billion cut to the Pentagon, even below the existing caps that cap Pentagon spending. Now, President Obama said to lawmakers in his budget, hey, I'll go above the caps. We can help staunch the pain of sequestration to the Pentagon and to military spending. I'll offer to go above those caps by around $55 or $58 billion. John, House Republicans are going way beyond him. They say, we'll go you one better. We'll go to $94 billion over the caps. We want a huge increase. But here's the problem. They also want to balance the budget and reduce the deficit. This budget promises to balance in 9 years and cut spending, not billions, John, $5.5 trillion. And so you say, all this money for increased defense spending to get around sequestration has to come from somewhere. How are House Republicans doing it? By pouring the money into an account that's not subject to sequestration, war spending, the account that funds the former wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's called OCO, Overseas Contingency Operations. And Tom Price is saying, let's put the money in there. It's not subject to sequestration. And then defense hawks in the House and Senate can feel good about Pentagon increases. John, the problem with that approach is conservatives, House conservatives who like sequestration. They like the spending limits, and they say, no gimmicks. We're all for the Pentagon. But we're not going for that.
Seems like a lot of gimmicks. If you look at the math here on the social side, $165 billion in cuts to food stamps and other so-called welfare programs. How are they going to do that?
Well, let's listen to Budget Chairman Tom Price talk about food stamps here.
The welfare programs, we encourage working as a component of participating in a welfare program for able-bodied adults. The SNAP program, the food stamps program, we believe is much better run at the state level as opposed to the federal level. Each and every one of those things gets you a certain amount of savings.
Would people feel those cuts, or is he just talking about closing loopholes and efficiencies?
No, they would absolutely feel them. The most of the savings in this proposed Republican budget come from big cuts to Medicaid and Medicare over 10 years. Now, up to $165 billion, as you said, has to come from other domestic programs, and that's food stamps are the biggest part of that. Now, you heard Mike Conway at the top of the segment that you played. He doesn't want to talk about how much of those remaining cuts would be food stamps because it's a little bit early. It's up to $165 billion. Remember, last year, Congress cut $9 billion from the food stamps program. Nobody knows how much those cuts could be if there's ever a budget agreement here, but it's definitely the case that this Republican budget envisions paying for a lot of those defense increases with cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, and Medicare. No doubt about it.
Does it also envision a presidential veto at this point?
That's almost inevitable. However, there's going to be a lot of negotiations down the road because the president also wants tax reform. And if Republicans can fold an agreement on tax reform into this big budget fight, there are a lot of decisions that have to get made.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
They talk about billions in Washington, but what about just the rest of us? From Portland, Oregon, a couple million would pay the bills and let my wife and I retire securely and help the grandkids with college. Too much money, and we'd spend too much time worrying about losing it.
Hi, this is Barbara Reynolds from Connecticut. $300,000 would make me feel rich. My husband and I could buy our own home, and that would make us feel very wealthy.
This is Sharon Green from Wareham, Massachusetts. $3 million would be my point. Enough to take care of all my house, my kids' houses, their cars, my car, pay off my mom's house. It's not things that make you rich. It's having the people around you safe and well.
Good thinking there. We want to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
After considerable polling and conjecture that he might lose, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared victory Wednesday in Israel's parliamentary elections.
Against all odds, we have achieved victory for the Likud party.
99.5% of the votes counted. Netanyahu and the Likud party have captured 30 of the 120 seats in parliament, and now Netanyahu has to form a coalition. Joining us is Shira Frankel, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. Shira, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How difficult will it be for Netanyahu to form a coalition, and what parties will he be relying on?
It shouldn't be difficult for him at all. He already has at least two parties who have sworn that they will join him in the coalition, both of those parties from the right wing, and he has others who are lining up to see what he's got on offer. It seems at the moment that this coalition could be run one of the most right-wing coalitions in Israel's history, now that parties like Zionist Union have said that they're not interested in joining. They'd rather sit in the opposition.
Is the economy a factor here in the end? Was this about security, even though so many people were talking about the economy in this campaign?
Well, the fact that Moshe Kahlon's Kulanu party, which campaigned almost solely on socioeconomic issues, did as well as it did, does show that the economy was a factor. Also, we saw Netanyahu in the very last moment on this media blitz talking about how he would pay attention to the economy and that socioeconomic issues were important to him. So he certainly played to that. And I met with quite a few people yesterday who told me that they believed that he was serious, that he had heard this call by the Israeli people to be more serious about improving Israel's economy, and that they were changing their minds to vote for him because they believe that he was now serious about this. Whether or not he actually acts on that and whether or not there are socioeconomic reforms made in Israel is left to be seen.
How much of this is Israelis really not seeing beyond Netanyahu, that he's kind of the only one who can do this job, functioning in the United States, being a sort of international figure on some level, and dealing with the very, very indecipherable Israeli domestic scene?
Oh, I mean, I think that's a huge factor. I can't even count the number of Israelis I spoke to yesterday who said that when it came down to it, they decided to vote for Netanyahu because they couldn't imagine anyone else being prime minister of Israel. I think that Netanyahu was very smart to play to Israelis' fears that if they didn't vote for him, they were going to get an unexpected and an unknown. And there were a few Israelis actually who told me that they had gone to the ballot box planning on voting for another candidate and at the last moment picked Netanyahu because they're, as they said, they're hearts told them to do that. And when I pried a bit further and said, what do you mean by your hearts? They all said the same thing, which is, well, you know, Netanyahu has been prime minister here for so long, I can't picture anybody else doing this job. So it just seems like Israelis at the end did want to go back to something they knew and something that was familiar.
And this is a fourth term, right?
This is a fourth term. And if Netanyahu does succeed in lasting in this term for 3 years, he will be Israel's longest serving prime minister.
Which is remarkable. So are Israelis expecting another cycle of the almost ritualized stories now of tension in Gaza, rockets from the north, possibly a crisis internationally with the Palestinians declaring a state of one kind or another? Is there any progress that can be made in the peace process, and wither the economy over the next 4 years?
I think Netanyahu made some comments in the last few days that are leaving a lot of Palestinians despondent over prospects for peace talks. He said that he was planning on expanding Israel's settlements in the West Bank, and he said that under him there would not be a Palestinian state. I'm not sure, you know, those people who are sitting in the White House right now and those people in the European Union that have worked on peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians, I'm not sure how they're going to look at those comments and still try to push forward some kind of peace negotiation at this point. It's completely possible that Netanyahu will walk back some of those comments. But the truth is that his government has not really moved forward with peace talks with Palestinians. And that's for a number of issues. The Palestinians have also not been in a situation where they can really throw their full weight behind peace talks. But I think that, unfortunately, those in this region who are living life along the Gaza border, and by that I mean both Palestinians in Gaza and Israelis, both told me yesterday that they're expecting there to be another war, another round of violence between the Israeli army and between Hamas militants in Gaza. They're expecting there to be another flare-up in the coming years because there was no resolution really to the last war. So they're sort of looking at this and saying, right, are we just going to go through the cycle again? Are we going to have another war and in 2 years' time another election? There wasn't a great deal of sort of hope and optimism from the people I spoke to down there.
So if there is any kind of vision here, it's to hold on to this you know, parking space in time and politics and really just keep your head down.
Yeah, it seems to be the case. And, you know, for all the talk here in Israel of revolution and there were groups such as one grassroots movement called V15, which really sort of put up this huge united effort to try and get Israelis to think about these elections differently, to vote on the basis of socioeconomic issues, to vote perhaps for parties that they wouldn't otherwise vote for. I think what we've seen in these elections that Israelis wanted the status quo. They wanted to keep what they knew, if not move a little bit further to the right.
And yet the rise of the Israeli Arabs in their success in the parliament suggests that the demographic clock is still ticking in Israel.
Certainly. I think the success of those Arab parties came down to two factors. One, which was the leader who managed to unite all those Arab parties together, Ayman Oudeh. He's come out as a real sort of rock star in the Arab public. I've seen people who are, you know, diehard communists and people who are Islamist praising him as a politician. He also did something rare, which is managed to appeal to left-wing Israelis and say, I'm not just here for the Arab sector. I'm here for anyone that wants sort of a left-wing candidate. And quite a few Israelis citizens I met with yesterday who would normally vote for a left-wing group like Meretz voted for him instead. Mm. He managed to bump up support in the Arab sector, which voted in higher numbers than they ever have before. And I wonder if going forward, this is a trend that we'll continue to see.
Shira Frankel, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Is Brazil's democracy going to make it to its 31st birthday? Brazil's 30th year of democracy is being celebrated, if you can call it that, with protests in 160 cities. On Sunday, protesters called once again for the impeachment of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, along with members of her Workers' Party, for their alleged involvement in a bribery scandal at the state-run oil firm Petrobras. 34 sitting politicians are also implicated, being investigated and accused of soliciting hundreds of millions of dollars in kickbacks from Petrobras. President Rousseff, who was chairwoman of the Petrobras board when the wrongdoing occurred, has denied any knowledge of it. A eleição
acabou. The election is over. There was a first round and a second round. A third round of the election for any Brazilian can't happen unless you want a rupture in democracy.
That's the president speaking to reporters earlier this month. Are Brazilians starting to believe that there's no way to govern their nation? Joining me now from Rio de Janeiro is Bruce Douglas, Brazil correspondent for Latin American Newsletters. Welcome, Bruce.
Hello.
So explain what it's like to be in these protests and how they're different from the kinds of things we've seen in the past.
Well, the protests on Sunday were on a very large scale, not quite as large as the protests we saw in June 2013. And in 2013, there was, at least at the beginning, quite a specific focus. There was a call for lower bus fares. Now the protests are much more generalized, and they are anti-government, anti-corruption protests. The demographic is somewhat different as well this time. Most of the protesters over the past weekend were from Brazil's wealthier, whiter elite, many of whom are deeply opposed to the government and have been opposed for a very long time. And I went down to one of the protests on Copacabana Beach on Sunday to speak to some of those involved.
We are here to fight against government because it's well known that they are thieving.
Our country has been destroyed by this party for 12 years. They destroyed our economy and they did everything wrong. All the plans were lies. They want to implant an old system of communism. It's just a big government of corruption.
Brazil is ruled by Otlar, who should be in jail right now. We are here today in order to demand a military intervention because the government do not respect the federal constitution. The government is our problem.
How is the military a plan B for that individual that you spoke with?
Well, the fact is Sunday was also the 30th anniversary of the return to democracy in Brazil. Those people calling for a military intervention, they are an extreme fringe, but not an entirely negligible one. They want the military to intervene because they actually see the legal obstacles to impeachment as being prohibitive. And so they think that the military takeover for a certain period of time in which new elections are organised would be the best solution. It does seem likely, given the collapse in the president's approval rating in just the last 3 months since she started her second term in office, it does seem likely that were there another election in 60 days' time, she would probably lose it. But clearly there would be severe both domestic and international ramifications for any attempt to realize this by military force.
Who rules Brazil? Is it this government or is it Petrobras, the huge a chemical and oil conglomerate.
Petrobras and its subcontractors is responsible for around 10% of Brazil's GDP. The crisis facing the company is estimated by some economists to shave off at least 0.75 percentage point of GDP this year. And this is already with Brazil looking at going into recession. So it is a major plank of the Brazilian economy. Its importance can't really be understated. I was speaking to a Brazil analyst the other day who was comparing the scandal there to imagine if all of the US oil majors were somehow involved in some massive cartel fixing organization. It's that equivalent, really. It's that huge. So Petrobras does play a huge part. Clearly, the president, the executive, has a key role to play and is not without her powers. However, Brazil's Congress is highly divided. The government has, in theory, a working majority, but that is only stitched together by a coalition. There are around 17 parties in the coalition. And at present, this crisis in the oil company is driving a wedge between the president's own party and her main coalition ally. And that makes any attempts to address this corruption problem very difficult.
Why is it that when Petrobras is flying high, that these curious relationships between politicians and Petrobras are tolerated, but when a recession moves in, suddenly people are questioning whether Brazil is even governable?
Well, with Petrobras, the story that's come to light is essentially that it was willingly overcharging on contracts in collusion with some of Brazil's biggest construction and engineering firms. And the excess money was being siphoned off to corrupt business leaders and to corrupt politicians. And the defense of some of those involved in the scheme is that this is just the way that politics is done in Brazil. Politics in Brazil is much more expensive, actually, even than politics in the US. As a result, they need money from somewhere to carry out these election campaigns. There are some people, including the ruling party, who are now saying this money needs to come from public sources. But others are saying that that's impossible to do and that there needs to be some kind of private financing. But since these revelations have come to light, and it's been about a year since the first inkling of this scandal started being published in the press, really the situation now seems to be completely untenable. There is now a congressional inquiry into Petrobras, as well as the Supreme Court investigation into the individuals responsible. But even those on the congressional inquiry looking into Petrobras, many of them owe their political careers to the private companies who are implicated in the scheme. So it is a huge mess. A private briefing note that was leaked to the press from the presidential palace last night talked about a country in crisis and with no easy way out. So it's hard to see how things play out from here, but certainly the next few months are likely to be extremely torrid for the president and her allies.
Bruce Douglas, Brazil correspondent for Latin American newsletters. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Feeling like $1 million to one class of Americans might be one putting the eighth hole at Augusta or getting to the green in two shots on the evil 14th hole at Pebble Beach. This lure of competitive golf is the front side of the business model that lures developers to turn pristine coastline and picturesque towns and villages into glitzy golf resorts. Anthony Baxter's film You've Been Trumped told the story of a Donald Trump golf resort and how it changed the population and landscape of a town in Scotland. And his newest film, A Dangerous Game, continues to tell the story of how golf is the bad guy.
This here used to be all full of wildlife, you know? No wildlife now, nothing. And I remember a way back, Trump says, oh, but the wildlife will come back. How can it come back? There's nothing here for him to come back to.
Anthony Baxter says that the Trump formula has been taken up by developers around the world with unfortunate social and environmental consequences that belie the fact that the golf industry has been in a recession for years.
Well, essentially, I think what happens is when big money comes into a community, and in this film, I focus on luxury golf courses, that money has access to the decision makers, to people that ordinary people don't have access to. And you see a twisting of democracy. So in some ways, the film is as much about democracy as it is about big luxury golf courses. In Scotland, where I live, Donald Trump came into a community and said, I'm going to build this massive golf course. It's going to bring all these jobs. 6,000 jobs was the original promise. But now we know, having seen the thing develop over a number of years, that only one golf course has been built. A fraction of the jobs that were originally promised have been delivered. And yet, a site of special scientific interest, one of the most protected sites in Britain, has been destroyed so that a few very wealthy people can play a few rounds of golf. And that is happening not just in Scotland, but all over the world.
And if you spend time in Dubrovnik, it's not in your top 10 list that what this place needs is golf.
Well, this is the ridiculous thing. I mean, in Croatia, less than 1% of the population plays golf. But there we see a similar situation to the one in Scotland. The developer, not Donald Trump, but somebody like him, comes in with a lot of money and has access to the airwaves, access to the political decision makers, and says, we're going to build this big luxury golf course on overlooking a UNESCO-protected site that many Americans will know from Game of Thrones. And we then see the local people feeling powerless to stop it. They're unable to. And so what they do there is they rise up and they say, we're not going to allow this to happen. They hold a referendum and they battle the developers and they lose the referendum. But the latest that we understand from that situation is that UNESCO are now going to visit the site. And hopefully we won't see the golf course. That's what the local people hope anyway, because it means if it's built that the water supply for the city is jeopardized because of the amount of water that that golf course will need on what is an arid plain and a very, very rocky one. And as the scientists say in the film, you know, we just don't need it. And our planet cannot afford these kind of golf courses to be built because they're not required by the local people.
What's the fantasy here? Is it like people from China are going to come and play golf, or the Japanese, of course, were obsessed with golf during the latter years of the 20th century? What is this inexhaustible supply of golfers with lots of money to spend that people actually take this argument at face value?
As you say, golf is in decline, yet we often see these developments being built as a smokescreen for building big luxury housing developments for super rich people. And many people are saying we need a moratorium on new golf course designs and builds around the world because we don't need another one. I mean, Scotland, for example, is stuffed full of golf courses. And yet there we saw Donald Trump come along saying, we need another one. And the Scottish government believing his promises that it was going to bring all these jobs to a community, by the way, which has 0% unemployment in Aberdeenshire. And yet he had access to the airwaves. He managed to convince the politicians. And the thing that was going to bring the income to him was the big luxury housing development. Because how much does it cost to play a few rounds of golf? Okay, these fees to join the golf courses are very, very high, but it's still not a massive money-making scheme. And so often, if you break it down, and the economists say at the London School of Economics we spoke to when making the first film, were saying that essentially the money that will come into his developments and into Trump's pockets will come in from the property deals and not the golf course.
Well, you've got the compelling environmental story. You've got characters like Trump. But there's an ingredient that I think is missing here. What's your personal stake? I mean, was your pet schnauzer run over by some golf course lawnmower back when you were a kid? Mm. Did some cricket pitch get bulldozed that really got you personally outraged at the golfers around the world?
Well, the reason I got into this story was because I live in Aberdeenshire and I live next door to one of the oldest golf courses in the world in Montrose. It's 450 years old. And I was struck when Trump came to Scotland of how the local media seemed to be reporting that this was going to be a great thing because it was going to bring all these jobs and economic development. But nobody was questioning the environmental impact. And I felt it was very important to tell that story and to try and get to the truth of what that impact would be. So I picked up the camera, remortgaged my house, made that first film, You've Been Trumped. Against all the odds, we had no support. We managed to get it on the BBC. We showed the film around the world, here in the United States and everywhere around the world. And Mr. Trump didn't like it because we were showing a side of the story that he didn't necessarily want to be told, and that is that environmental impact. And I think that it's really not so much about golf, because I don't play golf, but my mother was a very keen golfer. My uncle Dennis, who's in the film in A Dangerous Game, he's a very keen golfer. He finds 5,000 golf balls a year on Montrose links by just rummaging around in the gorse bushes. But he's also a very good golfer at 81 years old. So it's not as if I'm anti-golf and the film isn't anti-golf, but I just think we have to ask questions about how sustainable this kind of development for very, very wealthy people is.
A story told in the film A Dangerous Game, the follow-up film to You've Been Trumped by filmmaker, director Anthony Baxter. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And here's a little something to take with you today, kind of a souvenir. The beleaguered Secret Service wants a fake White House to train on, and they've asked to build a full-scale replica 20 miles from the real one. They say they can't use those little plastic souvenir White Houses you can buy from the vendors there on Constitution Avenue. They need to be able to defend the residents against people who climb the fence, run through the front door, and fly drones over the wall. And right now, they say they can only train on a parking lot.
We don't have the bushes. We don't have the fountains. We don't get a realistic look at the White House. And even our canine, they're responding on hard surfaces rather than grass.
They need bushes. They need fountains. That's Secret Service Director Joseph Clancy speaking to Congress. Given some of the recent Secret Service scandals, there was no mention made at the congressional hearing of whether there would be realistic fake bedrooms in the interior. Cost of this Secret Service souvenir White House, $8 million. How much would you pay for a souvenir? Give us your story at 8778MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Every day, The Takeaway involves listeners in the next day's program. You can help start the conversation via text message. Get your voice heard. Just text the word START to 69866. Standard message rates apply. Much less than $1 million. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. They're going to miss in lots of ways.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com.